Welcome to the Cine Fantastique Spotlight Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Horror Film in Review. I'm Dan Persons. I'm here with Cine Fantastique Managing Editor Steve Bedrowski. Hey, Steve.
Hello there.
Also with us is San Francisco Bureau Chief Lawrence French.
Hello.
And just a quick technical note, as I noted last week, I've been having audio problems. We are testing out my typical mic, which has been giving us grief these past few weeks, but we're trying recording it this time around. But that means that I may drop off at some point during the discussion, so Steve and Larry might continue on, or if we are really sharp about it, we may be able to do an edit. But just wanted to give you folks a warning about that. This week,
you may be sucked into an alternate dimension by a magic mirror.
Yeah, if only the magic mirror that we're going to be talking about actually did that. We are going to be talking this week about Oculus, which is, of course, a documentary rushed into release in the wake of the news of Facebook's acquiring the company. The film does go over the actual development of the Oculus Rift and their successful Kickstarter campaign. I may have the wrong film in mind.
Actually. Have a potato, Dan.
Yes, thank you. Weirdly enough, right at the point where this film was opening, there was this whole big news about a company called Oculus being acquired by Facebook, and their big deal is making a virtual reality goggle, which may or may not actually come to fruition at some point in the near future. The film we are talking about is Oculus, though. It's from Blumhouse Productions, which is now, I guess, calling itself BH Productions from the credits,
because initials are cool.
Because initials are cool, and why would you tag yourself with something that can be immediately recognizable when you could be confused with Bell and Howell, or a place that makes bagels? In any case, it is a horror film. It is I don't think this is the first BH film this year, is it? Or is it?
Well,
I'm not sure.
Paranormal Activity.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah,
coming out next week, right?
Yeah, but yeah, there was the marked ones before. So, and we've probably got lots more BH Productions films coming up. This is starring Karen Gillan. Yes, Amy Pond of Doctor Who is in this. And Brenton Thwaites. It's directed by Mike Flanagan, who prior to this did another thriller called Absentia. Story behind this is that 13 years after their father murdered their mother, a brother and sister reunite at their old home. The brother has spent all those years in a mental institution for killing the father in self-defense and has emerged accepting responsibility and believing his father to be a sadist and adulterer. The sister thinks that the atrocities that happened many years ago were the result of an antique mirror that hung in the father's home office, and she's lured the brother back to serve as witness to the mirror's power and ultimately to destroy it. We get to see what happened that fateful night in flashbacks that interleave and eventually overlap with events in the present, where we discover that the mirror may be more powerful than anyone could have imagined. And, okay, Steve, I don't particularly relish using this word because I think it's a word that gets overused, but frankly, meh. And you know what? It presents itself as a mind fuck type of film. The idea is supposed to be that the mirror takes control of people, and depending, and this is one of the confusing things. It can either confuse you into performing actions that you're not aware you're performing, or can control you directly and have you perform the actions without your realizing that you're performing the actions. It plays both ways in this. And I'm usually down with that type of thing, you know, the mind fuck type of film. What's reality? What's not? And quite frankly, there's nothing wrong with the production. Mike Flanagan does a pretty good job with handling the mind fuck, and in particular with having the past meld into the present. So there are points where the younger and older characters are in the same shot together, or between a cut you'll see an older character and then you'll see the younger character as well. That's interesting, and quite frankly, it left me cold. And I think the reason for me, the problem here, is, well, one of the things is that you have to believe that the characters, at the very least with this type of film, you have to believe that the characters, if you're not believing that they're capable of overcoming the evil, you have to believe that they believe that they are overcoming the evil. And then you discover that really the evil is more insidious and more overpowering than anybody estimated. And I don't get that feeling out of these characters. And also, I feel that really okay, you know what? I'm going to stop there and I'm going to let you sign off on it or give your impression of it, because, you know, basically I think the concept is good, but really the handling of it, particularly how the characters encounter it, doesn't quite work out. How was it for you?
Boring.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, you expected a fuller answer to your question.
Please, go on.
Well, it's predictable. It's formulaic. Whether it's Blumhouse or BH Productions, they've settled into this rut in which their horror films consist of this plot, which is new family moves into house and gets slaughtered. And at first it looked like they were going to do something different, because we were starting with all of that having happened in the past, and it was going to be this story about a brother and sister using a rather clever series of setups and mechanical and electronic devices and fail-safe plans to prove that the disaster in the past was caused by supernatural forces. But the flashback structure you mentioned just allows the Blumhouse people to insert their same old story again, which is, let's see the family move into the new house and get slaughtered. And we know that happens from the beginning, so it's rather predictable and boring. And as you say, with the present day story, the story we're supposed to be following, the characters initially seem like they have something going for them. They have a setup that may work. It sounds intriguing. But very quickly, the minute the movie goes into the whole mindfuck aspect of, yes, you could be doing this and not knowing it, and the mirror can be coaxing you to do things or putting you in this position or that position, it's immediately obvious that their fail safes are not going to work and they're in great danger and they should get out of there. So again, that story is equally predictable in its outcome.
Mm-hmm. Larry, how was it for you?
Well, as you both said, it has some very interesting ideas, and unfortunately, I don't think he brought them to fruition very well. In fact, they become so confusing towards the end, it's just like they sort of cross each other out. It's almost like they got short-circuited. And it's too bad because, you know, obviously, if the screenplay, as I said, had some very interesting ideas, but it becomes too, you know, it sort of goes into this surrealistic zone, and then where there's no rules and anything could happen. And by that point, you know, as Steve is saying, it's like so predictable. Who cares by that point? And you know, when you see a huge, she's got this one fail-safe device, which is like this huge
sledgehammer.
Sledgehammer axe type thing that's going to, you know, come down and hit the mirror, and you just know somebody's going to get up there.
Yeah, it's true.
So, it's Chekhov's gun.
Yeah.
Chekhov's loaded in the first act. You know it's going to fire in the third act. And not you know only that, you know the way it's going to misfire in the third act.
Mm-hmm. Right. The other thing is, you know, it sets up this interesting conflict between the two, the brother and the sister, and because the brother's been in a mental institution for 11 years, and when he gets out, he seems way more well-adjusted than the sister does. She's the one who's, like, raving about the mirror, and, you know, she believes in all its supernatural powers. And, you know, for the first half hour almost, when nothing really happens, we're wondering, well, maybe it was all in their minds. And, you know, they don't really go that way because it's quite obvious the mirror does have the supernatural mm-hmm. powers. But there's sort of this tension between the two siblings in the beginning, which, you know, is never maintained because as soon as the supernatural things start manifesting themselves, it's quite obvious that, you know, the boy's explanation is not doesn't hold any water whatsoever.
You see, Larry, I never bought into the ambiguity that possibly they are trying for in the film, because this is a Blumhouse film, and Blumhouse films don't go in for psychological horror or psychological ambiguity. It's all supernatural. And so, you know, from the beginning, you don't have any doubt because you know what kind of film you're in for. The thing about it for me is that, you know, you make a good point about the fact that after a while, you don't really care about what's reality or not. You know, there is a sequence at the beginning of the film where the scene where he's going to smash the mirror early on. Can I that's not really a spoiler. Can I describe the scene?
I'm not going to stop.
Okay, so basically she lures him into the place. She tells him, you know, the mirror is cursed, whatever. And he goes, well, why don't we just smash it? She says, okay, go ahead and smash it. He picks up a metal stool, goes to the mirror, plunks the stool down, and starts arguing with her again. And she goes, did you see what happened there? You couldn't. You got distracted. The mirror distracted you. And there are two things about that. One is the scene would have worked a lot better if attention to what had actually happened, it would have been better if they had delayed the explanation of what had actually happened in that scene. You could go, well, they're faking us out, but it shouldn't have been explained at that point. The other point is that right off the bat, it raises the question, if the mirror is that insidious, to use another Blumhouse title, and that powerful, then, you know, all bets are off, as Larry says. You cannot really say what is real and what is not. And the only way mindfuck films work is if there is some sort of question about what's the subjective camera and what's the objective camera, you know, and I can think of something like Videodrome as having pulled that off effectively. But here, there is actually no question of what's subjective and what's objective. Basically, from the point she calls out what the mirror has done, you basically say, well, everything could be subjective now. So, you know, what's reality, what's not? What the fuck does it matter? Steve, and any thoughts on that?
Nope, you said it all.
Okay, thank you.
Well, no, the thing
you
is...
You have to open the door on the conversation, not close it.
I thought this was opening the door, if you wanted to elaborate on it any further. Larry, did you want to say something further?
I thought it was very interesting because, as in the second half of the film, when they start possibly having hallucinations or it's the mirror affecting them, and then... it's like, you know, as Woody Allen would do, suddenly his character can go back in time and start talking to his younger self or something like that. So that was a very interesting idea because, you know, he starts off by cutting between the two time zones, you know, when they were kids and all this was happening in the house. And then he cuts back to, of course, the present day. And then suddenly the two characters are in the exact, you know, are in the frame with the two younger selves, as Woody Allen would do. So, you know, that was interesting. But then when suddenly they see themselves in the same frame, it becomes, you know, then it becomes everything falls apart for me because it's like, well, there's no rules here. Anything can happen. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you know, what, you know, then you don't understand where you are in the journey. So where is it?
Yeah, yeah.
It's, you know, it just, it really needed to have some grounding because it's a very interesting surrealistic idea. You know, it's like a René Magritte painting almost. But, you know, you have to be able to ground yourself someplace. Otherwise, it just goes anywhere, and which is what basically happens here. And it goes off the tracks and, you know, you don't have any kind of grounding where you can say, oh, this scene is fantasy, this scene is reality or whatever.
It's all interesting. You know, I the thing that I find so frustrating about this is that I think he actually has an interesting handle. Mike Flanagan actually has an interesting handle on how to tell the story, but I think he errs seriously in basically setting up the pieces and in giving us the ambiguity that we need to keep us engaged in things and keep us wondering, well, is this real? Is this not? The other thing that bothered me about it was really Karen Gillan's performance. You know, I don't know that this is really supposed to be, if her character, what is it? Oh, geez. What is her character's name?
Kaylee.
Yeah, Kaylee. If Kaylee is, I sort of feel that the brother is actually supposed to be the viewpoint character here, but Kaylee is actually the more interesting character. She's more the engine of the story. And the problem with that is that, here again, I was talking about the fact that I don't feel the characters are create an impression that they feel they're powerful enough to take this on. And I think that's particularly the case in Karen Gillan's performance. There's a point very early on in the scene where she comes upon the mirror at an auction house and she starts talking to the mirror. And there should be some sense of obsession about it, some sort of obsessive passion about it when she addresses the mirror that's maybe a little off and a little frightening. And I never get that in that scene or really in anything else that she does. And we sort of need that to hold the hook. She doesn't create the sense that she's more powerful than the mirror, believes she's more powerful than the mirror, and that she is really driven to destroy this mirror. I don't know. Were you dissatisfied with it, Steve?
No.
Okay.
Don't know what you're talking about. No idea. No idea. There's plenty wrong with this film, but no, not that. Yeah. I mean, they're much more fundamental questions, which is kind of the most basic one being, why was Brother Tim in a mental institution all these years? You know, what he did was in self-defense. I realize that might be traumatic and you'd be in therapy, but there's no way he'd be locked up all that time. I mean, you know, the intriguing thing, and, you know, Larry touched on it, was we have someone who's been in a mental institution, and even though he shouldn't have been there by rights when we see finally how things went down, and he's come out, and the idea he needs to protect his recovery, and now he's in a situation with family, which gets messy, and Sis is devoted to proving that this thing really is supernatural, and Tim is resisting that interpretation. Yeah, there's a whole movie to be made about that, and then they decided not to make that movie exactly because, as you said, it becomes a foregone conclusion pretty quickly what direction they're going to go with it. I think it's interesting that Larry compares it to a Woody Allen film, this technique of going from the older versions of the siblings to the youngers. But really, it seems that Flanagan's been watching a lot of Takashi Shimizu films, particularly Shock Factory, his 3D ghost story came out a couple years ago, which literally does this exact same thing from beginning to end of the movie. It's like these kids went to this amusement park attraction, something terrible happened, they go back as young adults, and there's this constant back and forth interaction of, oh, we're seeing our younger selves, and sometimes the younger selves are seeing the older selves, and it's like the two time zones have kind of overlapped to some extent, and it's kind of intriguing and it's weird, but it works best in a kind of spooky J-horror film, and it didn't even work so well there, come to think of it. And here it just gets, you know, kind of sloppy and messy, because like I said, it's an excuse to tell us the traditional Blumhouse film story, which we don't really need to see again. And so I was totally bored with those sequences, as I've indicated. And for a while, I thought it was going to work, because when they were going on this whole aspect of Brother Tim thinks it was all in their mind, Sister Kaylee thinks it was supernatural, I'm like, okay, we're going to see this Rashomon film where the flashbacks either conform or don't conform to either interpretation. Do they corroborate Tim's point of view or Kaylee's? Are we seeing these objectively, the flashbacks, or are they as the individual siblings remember them? There was a movie there to be made, but yeah, they didn't make that movie.
No, they didn't. Not at all. By the way, talked about missed opportunities. We were discussing this before we started recording. We all sort of flashed on the same realization at the same time, is that, you know, for all the opportunity that it offered up, there isn't really any sort of use of mirror physics in this. You know, this is not like Dead of Night, where you had that spooky moment where he looks into the mirror and sees a completely different room on the other side, which would be weird and creepy. But there's a little bit towards the end, a little bit of a special effects, Philip. But frankly, why a mirror? That could have been anything. It could have been the Zuni idol, you know, right, for all that it was a mirror.
Well, it's a gateway to another dimension. And yeah. I don't know, they should have maybe done more with it, but I think the mirror idea is good. And it's also, frankly, a great prop. So
it's a lovely prop.
Not so much the mirror, of course. It's the frame, of course, is intriguing and fascinating. It looks creepy and weird. So, yeah, I like that quite a bit. And, you know, for all the bitching about the story problems, I think the actual spook show aspects of it are pretty decent. The manifestation of what emerges from the mirror or is seen in the mirror. There are several good, you know, creepy moments, and it is reasonably scary as long as you don't fall asleep.
Here again, this drives me crazy. The production is quite good. There's stuff there that should be good, that should be impressive. There's one moment where the father has, for some reason, and they don't explain, but he's mutilated an alien, he's put a Band-Aid on it, and at some point it irritates him, and he takes the Band-Aid off, and then he looks down and he discovers the Band-Aid still on, and I don't want to go any further to explain what happens after that, but it's a disturbing and effective moment. And there's lots of stuff like that. Here again, the crossing over of past and present. All that's done really well, but yeah, Steve, boring.
Yeah. Sorry, Mr. Flanagan. I wanted to like it. I really wanted to like it. I mean, you know, to some extent, I'm willing to allow, or I don't know, credit or accept the kind of nonsensical approach people take in horror films. Towards the end, there were portions where it was reminding me of, you know, Lucio Fulci during the height of his career, around the time of The Beyond, where the supernatural elements didn't necessarily make sense in the story, but that almost became a comment. It was like the supernatural was destroying rationality, you know, and, you know, it was like chaos theory manifesting itself through ghosts and zombies and whatever. And you're like, yeah, it doesn't have to make sense because that's the way the universe works. It's all nonsense. It's crazy. You can't make sense out of it. So, you know, I want to give them credit that, yeah, that can be pretty freaky and weird. And like you said, it's a mind fuck. But that's not quite the movie they set up or pretended they were going to tell us. You know, that wasn't the story they were going to tell us. And as much as I like those elements, they kind of undermined what should have been a really, you know, kind of tense thriller with a sort of time lock situation of, yes, we have so many hours in this house before all hell breaks loose. I've got all these fail safes and devices set up, and, you know, we're planning for each contingency. And like I said, at a certain point when it became obvious to us that the plans were not sufficient because they don't even know what they're doing, they might be doing things and not knowing it, somebody should have said, hey, this isn't going to work. Let's get the hell out of here. Or at the very least, let's rethink our plans or try something else. Or, you know what, let's just flip the switch on the axe and destroy the mirror and get the hell out of here.
Larry, am I going overboard in wishing that the mirror was used better metaphorically in the film?
No, I don't think so. I would have liked to have seen that, too. I wanted to go back to you, to your other point, though, about Kaylee not being obsessed enough, because mm-hmm. that bothered me as well. Mm-hmm. And then especially because, you know, the mirror is up for sale at the auction house, and that's how she has access to it, because she works at the auction house. And there's that scene in where she goes, you know, back to have it delivered to her house. And then it becomes quite obvious when she, you know, when they go to the house and the mirror is there. She starts this whole exposition about the history of the mirror, which could have been really fascinating. But the way it's staged and played, I thought somehow it just didn't work. But I think that it certainly indicates her obsession with the mirror. But, you know, traditionally it would have been much more effective if somehow they had gotten the history from somebody else. Like she took her brother to see maybe an art expert at the auction house, for instance, and he would have explained, you know, the mirror originated at Balmoral Castle in Scotland and then came to America. You know, that would have become much more fascinating, because the way she tells it, it's all done so quickly. It isn't set up properly. And then, you know, you just, and like the brother, you're left, you know, thinking she's crazy the way she delivers it. So I thought that was a really botched opportunity, because that's usually a part in a horror film where you get this fascinating backstory about the mirror. And then, you know, they don't really, if this, all these people supposedly died in it, we'd never really find out the story of any of them. They're just little flashes. So that's another botched incident, I think. So there's all this
that they
could have done with the mirror and brought all these things in that they don't, you know, utilize. So I agree with you totally there.
She makes a weird reference to one of the owners having been morbidly obese, and then years later there's a photograph of him and he's lost weight. And there seems to be something about food and teeth that's going through all of this, but apparently the clues are only going to be explained in the sequel that we shall inevitably.
Yeah, well, apparently it's almost made $10 million in one weekend, which is probably more than its budget. So yeah. I presumably can start directing a sequel.
By the way, as far as going to somebody to have him explain things, Larry, if you haven't realized, Blumhouse films are the most agoraphobic films on Earth. They really don't want to leave the home.
Yes, I know. Well, they could have brought him in, too. I mean, for her to just be explaining it to her brother, they could have had, like they did in the first Paranormal Activity, you know, had somebody, a psychic expert, come to the house or something. But it seemed like there weren't enough characters there.
Steve, did I hear you? Did you want to get something in?
Oh, no.
Okay. Is there anything else we want to talk about before going into spoilers?
Puppies are sacrosanct.
Yeah, but do we know if the puppy actually ran away?
Yeah, he did. Yeah, he got out of there. There's some things you just can't do in a movie and not have the audience get up and walk out. And one of them is kill the puppy.
Kill the puppy. Okay.
Can't do it. In flashback, you can imply maybe it's happened somewhere in the vague past, but no.
That was a full grown dog. Anything else we want to talk about before spoilers?
The Weeping Angels?
Oh, yeah. Okay, go ahead, Steve. Yeah, you know, I noticed it, too. I saw it, and I said, Weeping Angels. But, go ahead. And
I guess they're technically not weeping, nor are they angels, but they are statues. And, it's just in the early scene when Karen Gillan's character is confronting the mirror, and in the reflection, she sees these figures draped in sheets, and they never move while she's actually looking at them, but when she's turned away, they seem to move, or she sees the reflections move and she turns around and they freeze. So basically they're doing the scene from Doctor Who with the Weeping Angels, and they do turn out to be statues underneath, which is close enough. Things that shouldn't move, but do when you're not looking at them. Out of the corner of your eye, it's creepy stuff. But yeah, maybe they didn't intend us to make that connection, but it can't be helped.
I am almost confident that they intended us to make that connection. That's their little gift to the Whovians showing up at the theater, I'm sure.
If they wanted to give us a gift, they should have made a better movie.
Well, yeah, that goes without saying. But I'm glad you said it anyway. And anything else we want to talk about before going into spoilers?
Yes, I wanted to just bring up, as Steve pointed out, there was no real reason he would be in a mental institution for 11 years. He might be in there for observation for a year or two. But, so that was a flaw in the story. But then I thought there was a real problem with, because it opens up with him seeing his doctor and he's, about to be released on his 21st birthday. And as I said before, it's too bad. If it was Robert Bloch writing this story, who would probably influence Flanagan, there would be a real question about whether he was mentally stable still. Mm-hmm. And it's almost, it's like in Psycho 2, after Norman is released after 22 years, it's quite obvious that even though he's pronounced cured, he's still got something wrong with him. So, and the way the performance is of the actor here, who's playing Tim, he's more a straight arrow, and it's like he's completely normal. So it's like, if he's been in a mental institution for 11 years, in fact, usually if you're in a mental institution for 11 years, you get worse because of the conditions. So I thought it would have been another missed opportunity to at least have suggested he might, be having hallucinations still or having traumatic flashbacks. And they don't really milk that for anything at all, because he's more of the rock here. And it's as Kaylee, who's, the one who seems a little bit over-obsessed.
Okay, shall we go into spoilers?
Sure.
Okay, so we are now going to go into the part of the discussion where we're going to discuss stuff about Oculus that you may not want to hear about if you haven't seen the film. Although, if you're steeped in enough horror films, you can probably guess what's going to be going on in this film as well. But if you do want to skip over this section, you can fast forward to 49 minutes and 7 seconds. And now we are in the spoiler section. This is your final warning. So, Steve, as you pointed out, Chekhov's gun... If you're showing the battering ram / sledgehammer / axe at the beginning of the film, certainly it's going to get deployed at the end of the film. The only surprise that came to me was I was expecting that they were both going to fall victim to it somehow, but it makes perfect sense, in sort of the circle is complete, that it happens the way it does, and only Kaylee gets exterminated. But I saw it coming, and as soon as you see him heading for the dial, you knew what was going to happen. So, any shock for you, Steve?
No, not really. Just how long it took to get there. it raises again some interesting points. Kaylee supposedly thought this through. Yeah, supposedly thought this through. And you're thinking, you know, she set up all these cameras and all this equipment. There's really absolutely no reason that they have to be in the room with the mirror for this to work. They could be monitoring it all from upstairs, across the street, out in a van. The door could be locked. There's no reason they have to be, you know, in harm's way. But that's one of those things characters do in these movies so that we can have the surprise ending. So it just, again, makes them look even stupider than they were. And even if she'd been initially confident, like I said, once they start having the hallucinations and realizing that they are having hallucinations, they'd be like, got to rethink this approach here because there's an obvious danger.
Yeah, you see, that's the point for me, is that once again, the power of the mirror is set up so early that you realize right off the bat that all of this stuff that she set up is bullshit.
Yeah.
You know, Larry, how about you? Shock?
No, not shock, really. You know, what was more shocking was initially earlier on when they're in the house, her fiancé comes over. And then, of course, she mistakenly stabs him in the neck. You know, by this time they're already hallucinating things. So I thought it was clever that, you know, she thinks, oh, I'm imagining this. It's not happening. And then she takes her cell phone out and pans it over him. And, well, guess what? She actually did kill him. So that would be an interesting way to separate that. But he doesn't go any further with it. And therefore, you know, as you go on in the movie, by the time the climax comes, you know, it doesn't really matter whether she's hallucinating or not, because as I pointed out, you know, anything can happen. So and anything will happen. So it doesn't really matter. And you sort of lose interest at that point. Mm-hmm. So I thought that it could have gone in if they had just had the, you know, set the rules down. And, you know, likewise, she did some clever things. It's like its influence is only whatever, 30 feet from it or whatever. So she's trying to measure that. And, you know, as Steve says, well, they could have just gone outside the room and done it all that way. You know, but of course, then you wouldn't have a movie. But in a way, you still could have the movie, but it would just have put these rules down where it would give you more grounding to it. Mm-hmm. And I think it would have been more clever to do it that way. But, you know, for these shock effects, it doesn't really matter.
You know, it's a little niggling thing, but, you know, at several points in the film, it's established that if you're looking at something through a video camera, specifically a camera in a cell phone, so you're looking at the screen through the cell phone camera, you don't see the illusion. You don't see what the mirror is making you see. But it raises a question. Why can't the mirror make you see the same stuff on the video camera that you're supposedly
don't,
seeing?
Do not ask. Do not question the powers of darkness. You're not supposed to ask that question, damn it.
the powers of darkness can control the human soul, but they can't set the clock on a VCR.
Nope. Well, what was weird about that was the film had gone to such lengths to imply, well, not even imply, just state outright that the mirror can influence electrical objects, which is why we're not trusting them, which is why this axe thing is on a mechanical timer. The mirror cannot physically turn a switch. Mm-hmm. You know, it can mess with so then it was weird that, oh yeah, but we can trust the phone's electrical image to be accurate. That was weird. You know, I'm willing to, you know, suspend disbelief, but when they actually contradict things they've set up, yeah, I think we're not obligated to grant them any leeway there at all. Yeah.
The question is perception. The question is, you know, it's a question of perception. If perception can be manipulated, and the suggestion is that everything that we're seeing is through their perception, what the fuck can be believed, you know? And going back to Videodrome, You know, one of the things that I thought Cronenberg did in there, and it's a small thing, but I think it was effective in the way it worked, is towards the end of the film, he would cut back and forth from James Wood. In one shot, he'd be holding an actual physical gun. In the next shot, you'd see the gun merged into his hand. And it was, a good way of keeping things ambiguous, but also giving you some taste of reality to understand what's going on. And the fact that we see everything through their eyes, there's just nothing like that. And I sort of give up. I say, well, what's real? Well, what the fuck does it matter?
Mm-hmm. It's hopeless. So yeah. Why get involved?
Yeah, really. Seriously. Seriously. Anything else anybody wants to talk about in spoilers?
One thing I was disappointed to as well was, very early in the story, it's introduced that Daddy's got a gun in his den. And we know that, of course, little Tim shoots his father with the gun. So, but I thought that was a very prosaic way of, showing that and just shooting his father. I mean, especially in a horror film like this, where they go, to lengths to have some sort of gruesome death. So, when he actually does, when we see in the flashbacks, he finally does shoot him. It's, it really doesn't have any suspense or anything different mm-hmm. about it. In fact, as I say, it seems like, very prosaic way to just kill him. And, and they do introduce the golf clubs and other things. So there'd be all sorts of more interesting ways for that to have happened. And, just to get a gun and shoot somebody, especially in today's horror movie climate, it's not a very exciting way to do it.
By the way, I was a little annoyed at that dream sequence at the beginning of the film, because first of all, it's not the way events actually happen, as we see subsequently in the film. And I just sort of felt and even though you can say that, yes, it does help to set up the visual trope of characters going between their two ages in the film, it just felt to me like just sort of a cheap way to get sort of like a shock action moment at the beginning of the film. That, and I don't think it was particularly necessary. Anybody agree or disagree?
I'm finding it hard to care.
Yeah, okay.
So, pathetic.
Is that a problem with the way I presented the idea, or?
No, I'm just saying, in the context of the whole movie, it's not like, yes, the finely wrought structure came tumbling down okay. because they didn't set it up properly. It's like, yeah, whatever,
Okay.
Yeah, that's the problem. It wasn't set up properly. That's the whole thing. Yeah. And then, and then it's supposed to, circularly, it's supposed to, because then he sees he's killed his sister and he realizes, oh my God, what have I done? But even then he's not, he's definitely not crazy. But then they lead him away. Obviously, everybody's going to think he's crazy mm-hmm. because yeah. nobody's going to believe his story. So,
well,
it's
a sequel where he goes, on trial and says, well, yeah, I killed my sister. She just killed her her fiance. And I thought she was going to kill me next. It was self-defense.
Yeah.
Well, it's actually, not like there's not going to be a record. Terrible thing.
They have an excuse to get off, because all that, videotape will be there. I mean, they can present that at the trial, right? So you can see, we'll see what really happened and what was imaginary. And, if it turns out that he did kill her, then he'll have to spend another 11 years in an asylum.
Steve,
if they had more money, they could have done this as a courtroom movie and told the whole movie through the video.
We're doing that's the sequel. Steve, I feel, once again, I feel fairly confident that they did not consider the logic to that. And,
no.
Darn it. By the way, just a smaller side note, this isn't really a spoiler thing, but one of the things that she sets up is that she's got a time at the what one of the things she sets up at the beginning of the film is that she's got all these timers, and one of the timers is there so that she can switch the tapes in the video cameras. And I sat there and I went, it's 2014 and you're still using cameras with videotapes?
So am I.
Well, you know, I mean, you know, it's...
Well, are you saying my camera's no good?
I am saying your camera is perfectly fine. I am saying that the woman who probably bought the cameras right before doing it, and by the way...
She's been planning this a long time. She bought that equipment 10 years ago.
Maybe. Expensive professional cameras, by the way, because if you'll notice, the handles all had XLR audio input sockets in them. Mm. So those are pro cameras. I get what's her boyfriend doing? Is he a lawyer or something?
Well, I don't know, but she's working in a high priced auction house.
Oh yeah, that's true. So yeah, she's got the money for it. Okay.
And we see she's not averse to a little larceny.
Yeah, true too.
Auction.
Okay.
Who knows? Maybe she borrowed all that stuff from the auction house. Maybe they have all kinds of video equipment to make sure people aren't stealing the paintings. Although she actually walked out of there with one pretty easily. But there you go.
Okay, so anything else we want to talk about in spoilers?
I'm glad the puppy didn't die.
Okay.
That would have ruined that for me completely.
Anything else, folks?
One
you gotta
thing,
hang on to something, Steve, after all, right?
Yeah, one thing we should talk about in spoilers is the manifestations that start happening, you know, from the mirror, and then start actually appearing in the house because, you know, in the past, 11 years ago, it's just this one woman who appears in their father's den, and that leads to Tim thinking his father is having an affair, which explains it all. And then, of course, towards the end of the movie, more and more images and people from the mirror start appearing in the house, mm-hmm. which to me just became a little far-fetched because why are suddenly they now appearing, you know, and none of them have been set up before. And, you know, frankly, none of them were very frightening. They're the typical ghoul type, you know, with glassy eyes. Mm-hmm. And you just, you know, it wasn't thought out enough. They should have set those people up, you know, or, you know, just made it the one person. Just because you have more doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be more frightening. And I don't think in this case it was.
Yeah, I know.
So it was another case of a half-baked idea. Actually could have been a very good idea, but it didn't reach its... logical conclusion or proper conclusion.
You know, what I'm getting really tired of, and this is another Blumhouse thing, is giving you the little dribs and drabs of backstory that apparently is going to be doled out in minuscule amounts from sequel to sequel. You know, and, you know, what's going on with Paranormal Activity is a certain amount of retconning because they never expected things to happen. But now they're doing it deliberately. And it's like, as I say, there seems to be a whole issue with teeth and perhaps eating that ties into it. And something perhaps, I forget the name. What's the name he writes? I want to say Carlotta, but it isn't that. It was another name of Latin origin.
Oh, nay, what was it? It was Marisol.
Marisol, that's it. Yes, right, Marisol.
Oh, that was another thing because, he seems to be obsessed with this woman, mm-hmm. and her name was Marisol. So that was like, and that's the last we hear about her.
Yeah.
So it's like she just appears. And, you know, they could have given her a much richer history and made Marisol this, you know, another character. And that would have helped the mirror become more threatening and more intriguing. And instead, it's like he's writing Marisol down, you know, sort of like Jack Nicholson does in The Shining. And, you know, nothing is ever made of that after that. She just appears a couple times and then, you know, suddenly there's like 100 different people. Or, you know, not 100, but maybe 10 or 15. So.
Yeah. Once again, these are tantalizing glimpses at the backstory. And this is where I join Steve in the don't give a fuck boat.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay. Shall we get out of spoilers?
Yes.
Okay, so let's get out of the spoiler section right now. And welcome back. If you skipped over the spoiler section, we actually found some rather tantalizing spoilers to discuss about Oculus, so you may want to go back and listen to that section if you did skip over it. Once you have seen the film, it's time now for us to give our ratings. So, Steve, 0 to 5 stars, what do you want to give Oculus?
I'm in a grumpy mood, so I'm going to give it a 1 star.
Wow.
I strongly recommend you don't see it. As I indicated, there was some spooky stuff in it, but it was just too boring.
Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. How about you, Larry?
I'm going to give it 2 stars. I thought that had so many interesting and intriguing ideas, and I thought if probably a more experienced screenwriter had taken this script and then, you know, reworked it, like they always do in Hollywood anyway, it might have turned out a lot better. But, you know, that's not to say that in future films, Mike Flanagan obviously has a lot of talent. It's just that it didn't really come to fruition in this movie.
Yeah, I'm going to give it 2 stars as well, pretty much for the reasons Larry lay out. I see the talent there, and quite frankly, if this is the sort of thing you really want and you know what you're in for anyway, it's not a bad way to go. You know, the most entertaining thing about seeing this film actually was I saw it Saturday evening. It wasn't a packed theater by any stretch, but there was one woman in it who was really getting into it, you know, like every shock, every reveal was like, you know, that sort of thing. And I actually got more entertainment listening to her be entertained than I was getting from the film itself. You know, I shall not begrudge her the pleasure if she was enjoying that. I wish I could have joined her, is all. So that is Oculus. Another film opened this weekend, Rio 2. And Steve saw that, right?
Yes, we'll be talking about that in Dossier Fantastique.
Sounds good to me. Okay, so
sounds good.
we'll find out eventually this Wednesday or thereabouts. Before we go, let's cover what's coming to theaters this Friday, April 18th. Okay, the big thing and the most intriguing thing certainly is Transcendence. Johnny Depp plays a scientist whose mind gets uploaded to a computer and who becomes drunk with power, if I'm reading the trailer correctly. It's sort of a Colossus the Forbidden Project Part 2. Rebecca Hall is in there as well. Morgan Freeman, Cillian Murphy is in there. What makes this most intriguing is that this is being directed by Wally Pfister, who's best known as Chris Nolan's DP. It's his feature film debut. So, you know, at the very least, this is probably going to look gorgeous. Where it goes from there, we shall see. But intriguing, yes. Curious, at least enough to raise curiosity, is it not, guys?
Oh, yeah.
I'm not sure there's anything intriguing about a cinematographer making his first
direction. Well, yeah, I know. It can go either way, but, you know, still, you know, given the connection and given the ties, one can hope. In addition, opening next week or next weekend, A Haunted House 2, part 2 of the satirical film that, Steve, you and I actually enjoyed the first one quite a bit.
Yes, indeed.
And watching the trailer, I'm not so sure about this one, but then again, watching the trailer of the first film, I was sort of mezzo-mezzo. So here's hoping that they can land this one. In addition, a couple of limited releases, and the one that I think at the very least will have Steve salivating is Godzilla, the Japanese original. A re-release of Godzilla, or Gojira, if you will. It's opening in New York at Film Forum. I don't think it's opening in Los Angeles, is it, Steve?
Well, it's going city by city.
City by city. So it'll be getting around and hopefully, and I don't know.
I mean, it's playing the, you know, TCM Classic Film Festival
yesterday
in Hollywood.
Yes,
so we actually beat it New York.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. And actually, I missed a couple of opportunities to go see it. I really wanted to go see it. Hopefully, I shall get to a screening, because I've never seen the original Godzilla. And so I would... Now's my chance, if I can get to it, Under the Skin first, because I still need to see that. Also, being... Sorry, Steve?
I said you should see something good.
Well, yeah, true. You would then recommend Godzilla, I'm presuming. Yes, indeed. Okay, so in any case, in addition to that, also limited release in New York City, and this is borderline. I'm not too sure about this, but I'll mention it anyway because it is coming out of IFC Midnight. Proxy, directed by Zach Parker. I'll read the synopsis here. Esther feels alone in this world when she is viciously attacked by a hooded assailant. It almost seems to be a blessing in disguise when Esther finds consolation in a support group, especially from kindly Melanie. The two women strike up a close friendship, and Esther's life of sadness and solitude is opened up to understanding and even acceptance. However, their bond gets increasingly dangerous as they can no longer tell what's real and what's in their heads. And the press release makes note that Zach Parker had previously done the perceptual thriller Scalene. Do either of you know about this?
Afraid not.
Okay, so I don't know. Considering the fact that you could consider Oculus a perceptual thriller as well, so I don't know what that means. In any case, that's what's coming next week. So we shall get out of here. Before we go, let me point out that if you want to write about anything you've heard in the show or about anything regarding genre film at all, you can send the email to podcast@cinefantastiqueonline.com. Lawrence French, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Steve Bedrowski, thank you as well.
Welcome.
We got through the show with this microphone. Yay! Things are back to normal.
Good news. Maybe.
In any case, I'm Dan Person. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And remember, greet every day with a sense of wonder. Copyright 2014, Upstart Company, NYC. All rights reserved. No unauthorized duplication permitted.